Committee on Veterans Affairs, and I welcome you here today. Today is Thursday, January 27th, and we don't have a work session today, do we?
Well, we have a work session for the purpose of introducing legislation, if you wish to do so, Madam Chair. We have a copy of a legislative draft that the Legislative Council has given to us, which we asked for, and we can at this time, if you wish to. It's real easily done, so yeah, we can do that first.
Okay. All right. We do have a work session today, as well as an informational meeting on today's agenda. And I will now open a work session. And Mr. Administrator, what do we have?
This is Legislative Draft 2037. It has to do with educational benefits for veterans. I have copies of it if any of the members want. Ordinarily, we don't distribute copies unless people want them. It would be for your introduction as a committee bill requires formal action of the committee. I would suggest if you're interested in discussing the issue itself, we do that at such time as the bill is referred back to the committee.
Thank you. Do we have a motion to introduce legislative draft LC 2037 as a committee measure? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would so move, and I would ask that the relating clause be read. I'm not sure I heard it.
Relating to educational benefits for veterans.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Barnhart moves that we introduce legislative draft LC 2037 as a committee measure. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, it is so ordered and the legislative draft will be introduced. I will now close the work session. I will now open the informational meeting, and we're really pleased to have two different groups on our agenda today, the Employment Department and also the County Veterans Service officers. First, at each one of our meetings, we want to honor any veterans who are in our audience and let you know how much we appreciate you. So if you're a veteran or a member of the current military, would you please stand?
Wow.
And we thank you so very much for your service to our country, and we do know that freedom wasn't free and it isn't free, and just God bless you all. And we also want to represent Representative Boquist, who is a member of the current military. Also, just remind those who will be speaking today that we do have a Veterans Fund in this committee. And the way we make money for this fund is for you to use acronyms. So during your testimony, if you should slip and say GI Bill or VA, we'll just ask you with your own integrity to contribute to the basket as you leave the room today. And we'll right now express our appreciation to you, and we'll leave you on your own good merit. Okay. Our first presenter today is Jim Booker from the State Veterans, who is a State Veterans Program Coordinator from the Employment Department.
Madam Chair.
Representative Boquist.
If you'll indulge me just a second, several of the members were gone yesterday, and I know the letter that I sent to the Employment Department has been distributed, and I know I will get this correct, and I know that Representative Hunt, Representative Farr, I think Representative Kopp, and we did use Representative Phil Barnhart's name, of course, in the signage discussion about putting signs up in the veterans. But I think that letter's been distributed. Yes. Those members were here before, and Mr. Booker and others who have been testifying, I mean, they have come over, they've taken action, they're making sure things are happening and corrected things. And so please don't hold that against Mr. Booker today. I'll hold it against him next week. But thank you.
Thank you, Representative Boquist. For those who don't know what we're talking about, we were advised that perhaps those who apply for jobs do not know that there are special considerations if you are a veteran. And so we've asked all the employment divisions across the state to post a notice that, you know, says, please tell us you're a vet so that we can apprise you of the full services veterans are entitled to. Thank you very much, Mr. Booker. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate your indulgence in that. We are working on the solution to that. The last time we were here, I'm Jim Booker. I'm the Veterans Program Coordinator for the Oregon Employment Department. Last time we were here, some questions were asked, and I brought the answers to those questions back with me. One of the questions was, how many veterans have we served? I took a snapshot of the program year 2003. That would be from July 1st, 2003. To June 30th, 2004, we served as 44,820 veterans. Another question that was asked was, how many veterans are unemployed? Got some information from the current population survey that says that 17,000 veterans are unemployed in Oregon. That number might not match up completely with some of the unemployment numbers we have, because the current population survey takes into account people whose ages 20 and above, and our normal or some of the other sources that we report out on unemployment take into account 16 and older. So that could make a little bit of difference in the numbers, but that is a good number, a good representation of how many are unemployed. Another question that was asked was, how many or what are some of the needs that veterans have that we might not be meeting, that we might not be seeing? And I did a survey of the folks that work for us in the employment department, everyone really, from the managers to the local veterans employment representatives and the disabled veterans outreach program staff. And we found several things that we could identify readily, one of which is the need to make sure that we're doing a good job of marketing, because we are aware that people don't always know that they are a veteran, because in some cases, in the past, if you were a National Guard member, you weren't a veteran because you didn't meet the number of days on active duty service or whatever. So we're doing we're making sure that we do get signage up. I did get an email out to our staff and said, make sure that when someone walks in your office, come out, walk back in it, look for yourself and see, is it something that's readily available? And we have had a concern sent to us saying that it wasn't, and we went to look at that particular office, and we'll be fixing that situation. Another, besides marketing, because we do want to make sure that veterans are aware that they have benefits, another issue is money for things like licenses. Sometimes the only thing that stands in the way of someone's employment is $50 for a license fee, and they're just not able to come up with it. They've been out of work. And in some cases, our own fundraising efforts outside of our work time provides money for that, and sometimes we just don't have it. We try to find sources wherever we can. Other things that are issues for folks besides that kind of thing, money for equipment, basic equipment that you might need to start a job, like work boots or something like that. Other issues would be transportation issues. We talked about this the last time I was here. We have in the past, wherever possible, provided bus passes in metro areas, gas cards, things like that. That remains a problem because, again, we don't have funding for that kind of thing. We have to try to find funding for that in other places. I've not been very successful in getting bus companies to donate that, and I don't want to say anything bad about it. I think they do a good job, and I think it's difficult to do that for them. We have purchased gas cards in the past, and we've discovered some problems with those. Gas companies begin to take the value down of them after a period of time, so you can't hold on to them for a long period of time. Also, with the changing price of gas, your gas card may have been worth $10 yesterday, and it isn't today. So that can be a problem. I think another issue that we had that doesn't come directly under employment, but of course it comes in front of us, is that families occasionally need help with things like rent, and maybe there's a maintenance problem at home and you can't take care of it because the person who normally does that maintenance work is away. Things like that. Now, that's not an employment-related issue, but like I said, it confronts us daily. We meet families of troops who are out and need that kind of help. what kind of actions are we taking to help with these things? I did talk about already that I sent out an email to all of our staff, to everyone. It's been reiterated by some of the highest levels in our department. Get out there and make sure that people know that we have services available to them. Whether it's signage, whether it's refreshing the training of the people on the frontline staff so that they're aware when someone comes up and they ask for veteran services that they can get that help somehow or another. We're also, like I said, we've done fundraising efforts on our own to try to meet some of these needs that people have that are outside the employment arena, or if they are kind of related to the employment barriers, we try to do that. We're working very closely with the Oregon Military Department. Colonel Caldwell is back here, and he and I have been developing a relationship. I've been working on a committee that Congresswoman Darlene Hooley has called about veterans' conditions and affairs and what they need. And I've noted that several of the members of this committee are involved in that also. We're doing quite a bit of brainstorming and coming up with solutions for things that, you know, we didn't know about a year ago or even 2 years ago that we're deciding, hey, you know, we should have thought about that. And so everything from employers having problems. We talked to an employer at one of those committees that said, you know what, if someone comes back and I hire them back and they're exhibiting some stress-related issues, what do? I don't even know who to go to. And so we're looking into things like that so we can help out. The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs has been very proactive in working with us and us working with them on issues of homeless veterans in particular. I know that Director Willis has had a really good idea. It's just get the agencies who do what they do to do what they do together to help veterans. And one of the things that he was working on that we're willing to help with and ready to is to get some housing for homeless veterans and then provide counseling and employment services, etc. And we're on the bandwagon with him on that, and we would like to do that. So we're very interested in working with any agency, and we're looking for agencies that have ways of touching veterans' lives that we can somehow work with. In my meetings with the Oregon Military Department, I asked one of the returning troops, I said, you know what, I think we could use some refresher training on what it feels like to come back. I mean, for some of us, Vietnam is a long time ago, although the memories of coming back are very strong for some. For others, we're veterans, but we didn't necessarily have any issues like that. And we may have received some training in it 5 years ago or something, but I think it would help to have someone come back and say, you know, the first 30 days, I don't care what you do. I want to get home to my family. And that's helped us decide on programs that we may be putting in place very soon. We've looked at creating a transition assistance program for veterans who are coming back that would relate directly to employment needs. It would be voluntary for any guardsman or any veteran that needs help with transition from military to civilian life. It would involve everything from how to use the right civilian terms instead of acronyms, how to write your resume in a way that would be acceptable to a business and that they can see that what you're doing is valuable. Just all sorts of things. Registering with our new computerized registration system so that we can match you up to the job that's best for you. That's in the works. We're planning it right now. We're willing to do that with or without funding. I mean, we would do things similar to that anyway, but we would like to get some funding for the books that have been produced by Department of Labor that we talked about last time, that we don't have funding for that because we don't have an active duty military base here. But we'll find a way to do it. And so things like that. We're looking at anything we possibly can to meet the need, and we are grateful for this committee and others that have shown us things that we need to look for. And it's definitely opened my eyes, and I'm glad, because that's what we do. We like to serve our veterans. We are veterans. They're our brothers and sisters, and we care about them. I did want to mention that I brought two of our best veteran representatives with us. I brought Stan Stanley from North Portland, who is a local veterans employment representative. And from Salem, I have... What can't I think of your name? Oh, yeah. What? I'm sorry?
Terry Rich.
Terry Rich. You know, actually, I know Terry very well, but when you're sitting in front of people, sometimes it's hard to remember. Terry Rich is a disabled veteran outreach program staff member. I brought them in case you might want to hear what it's like to be a person on the front lines helping people. They've all had experiences with folks coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And, of course, we just don't forget the fact that there are veterans from all wars and just serving that are still out there that we have that we help also. So,
Mr. Booker, we'd like to invite Mr. Stanley and Mr. Rich to join you. We do appreciate your service. Great ties. Mr. Rich, would you identify yourself, please? We can move that microphone over.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Terry Rich. I'm a disabled veterans outreach program specialist, currently assigned to the veterans section in the Salem field office.
Thank you. And Mr. Stanley?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Stan Stanley. I am a local Veterans Employment Representative serving with the North Portland Office Veterans Unit in North Portland.
Thank you very much for being here. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Mr. Booker.
The only other thing I had was I brought a few things that we've distributed with you. There's a poster that we're working with the National Hire Vet First Committee, and this is one that we've distributed in quantity to all of our offices. That it, actually, you can use it as a brochure to help employers understand why they should hire veterans, but also you can give it to a veteran. It will help them write their resume out. It gives them some things to think about why they're valuable. I distributed another one about hiring the vets or the best, which is directed towards employers. I brought served in the United States military. This is one that we have available at all our offices. We take the job fairs. We get out any way we can. This is directed toward the veteran, and it talks about the services that we have available, where they're available at. It's how you qualify to be a veteran, etc. I brought you all a copy of a marketing piece that we have. At the very end of the year, last year, our marketing folks said, you know what, we got a little bit of extra money left. How would you guys like some marketing help? And I said, great, I'm always looking for ideas. And so they had these calendars, and we've got our logo and Hire a Vet on there. And on the inside, there's a blank space where the individual representatives can put their information, and we hand these out primarily to employers, but whoever you feel like needs a marketing effort, they can go to. And it's just kind of a nice little thing to hand out to somebody. It's a planner that people can use. I also brought another success story. We really have a lot of them, and I don't want to inundate you, but I did want to show you one about a disabled vet who, with our help, was able to get some, and with the help of a hospital in Grants Pass, was able to get some help and get hired. And I just thought you'd find that very interesting. And Madam Chairman, that really is the end of my testimony, unless there are any other questions.
Thank you very much. For you gentlemen, I would just like to ask you a question. At the end of our last committee meeting, after we'd been dismissed, a young man came in and said, is this a veterans committee? We said yes, but it was over, and we explained to him we would have welcomed his testimony and come any time because, you know, anybody's welcome. And he said, well, I'm here because in Portland we have a man by the name of John Mills who's with Company C. He's a double amputee in a wheelchair. He's homeless, doesn't have a job, and I want you to help him. And, of course, I immediately said we'd be happy to help him, and so did our administrator. Could we have a phone number? He doesn't have one. Well, could we have his address? He doesn't have one. Could we have your phone number, and maybe we could contact you, and you could take us to him? I don't have one. And so at this time, my staff is working and attempting to locate Mr. Mills in Portland somewhere. I'm just curious, we have many individuals like this who are homeless, and could you tell us how do we even go about helping someone like this?
One of the great things we have working in this direction is homeless veterans and homeless people in general are at times very difficult to locate. We have connections to places like Central City Concern and who else in Portland, Stan?
Through Challenges the group.
We have many connections. I know in Clackamas County, it's Community Solutions for Clackamas County. And then all over the state, there are places that specifically reach out to the homeless and try to find them. We have partnerships with them, and we make sure that they know we're there. I know that specifically with Community Services of Clackamas County, we help them get a grant from Department of Labor that is a marketing grant that has billboards, some television, and backs of bus advertising to let veterans know, homeless veterans particularly, that we're out there to help them. And it's a partnership so that when the veteran comes in to them, they'll get the medical help or mental health care that they need, and then we're there as a connection for the employment help whenever we can. So we are out there. Homeless veterans is one of the focus groups that Department of Labor has us working on, along with incarcerated veterans who also have problems getting work. So we definitely have connections.
Yes, ma'am. Curious, Mr. Booker, how can we find John Mills to get him help today? Do we have a team that goes out and scours Portland and to find Mr. Mills, to find this vet that desperately needs our help?
What we can do, of course, is run a name check through our system to find out if he's in fact registered in or with the employment department. If he is, we can use that information to at least narrow the circle a little bit to help that surge. We can check with our contacts in the homeless shelters to find out if this individual has been served by them. And if so, if he's still there, or find out somebody that knows him, and then go from there. Basic investigative techniques will probably turn him up fairly well.
We very much appreciate that. If you could do that, let's see how the system works. And also, I believe this committee would appreciate getting this list of statewide housing units that cater to our veterans, and we can also disperse that information here at the legislature, and since we cover all districts of the state, all the senators and representatives could have this information so they could help individuals like this.
I'd be glad to get that list to you, ma'am.
Thank you. Any other questions this morning for this panel?
Yeah, just one, if I may.
Representative Barnhart.
Are there, and you might expand on this if I don't get the question quite right, are there mail drops or communication systems that are designed in the Portland area for homeless people to use as a way of keeping in touch with other people? I know that in Eugene, for example, there are places where those who don't have regular addresses can go to get their mail and to make phone calls and things of that sort. Are there similar facilities in
Yes.
Portland and in other parts of the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, yes, there are systems available. Sometimes they're stressed to the max.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, based on individual needs, we do or work with entities that can provide mm-hmm. the service, such as the Portland Vet Center has allowed their facilities to be used by not necessarily homeless, but veterans who were not able to afford telephones to use those spaces to conduct their job search and use that address as a drop form. And it has been successful.
Yeah, but Chris, that is obvious, often one of the biggest problems for people who don't have a regular address. How are they going to communicate with a potential employer or even with their families.
That's correct.
Yes. Thank you.
If I may expand on that, Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, one of the things we do have available is a community voicemail where we can give a homeless veteran a telephone number that he can give to employers so that an employer can contact them. We can also use that community voicemail to contact them ourselves. We also have a Veterans Administration Veterans Center in Salem that we utilize for contacts, we utilize for addresses, and we could meet folks down there. We provide emergency food boxes to assist with homeless veterans. That's a box of non-perishable food items that lasts an individual 2 to 3 days. These are some of the resources that we as veterans representatives have gone out and trying to find so that we can have them for particularly for our homeless veterans.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Okay, if not, we want to thank you very much. We appreciate you, and thank you, Mr. Booker and Mr. Rich and Mr. Stanley.
Thank you.
Next, we'll be calling on our County Veteran Service Officers, and Jacqueline Zimmer. If you come forward, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jacqueline Zimmer, and I'm the director of the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. And I'm going to use our acronym just because you're going to hear it around the building, but I brought my wallet for myself and my friend here.
Oh, good.
So
we appreciate it.
Do remember that I'm a lobbyist for a nonprofit organization. Madam Chair,
I got a thought.
thank you, sir. The Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities is a unique organization in that we provide services to seniors and younger people with disabilities. That's the 18 to 64 crowd who are perhaps suffering from MS or have had a stroke or their accident, recovering, those sort of impairments, not necessarily developmentally disabled, but the physically disabled. And what we've done in our system, which was the model for the rest of the nation, was to integrate services as best we could around the state in areas that were willing to do so. We put an Area Agency on Aging office together with state services, and in some areas we transferred actual state employees over to those Area Agencies on Aging, and we created a one-stop shopping system for seniors and people with physical disabilities. So gone are the days when as you aged and you needed the health plan or food stamps or any such services that you had to travel from place to place to place. So in most areas of the state you can go to one facility and get your needs met in most areas of the state. At any rate, in some of those offices, we also provide services to county veteran services officers are there to provide services because so many of the clientele that we serve are, in fact, aging veterans or they are eligible for veterans benefits and so forth. So it made sense to link that in some of those offices as well. So by way of that system, I've been helping advocate for adequate funding for those county veteran services officers for a number of years, and the reason that I spend so much time on this is that when I began in the legislature in 1991 as a staffer, the county veteran services officers were receiving, I think, $12,500 per year for each one of those services officers. So that was, I didn't think very much money at that time, and I remember their funding being at risk. And then as I came back into the system as a staff person to O4AD, the funding hadn't changed, and that was in 1995, and today that funding amount remains the same. So I'm quite certain that that is not in keeping with the increasing number of veterans or the cost of doing business and so on and so forth. To us, the value of having a county veteran service officer is immeasurable simply because there are a number of veterans who are using the state Medicaid system and the state long-term care system because they've given up on obtaining their VA benefits, or they didn't realize they were eligible. And any time that we can help someone navigate that system, that paperwork, that application process, we could be successful at moving them off of the state Medicaid system, thereby freeing up a slot for some other person who needs services. And so my peer here, Jeff Hill, came up with an idea for a pilot project in 2001, which would create a little bit of additional staffing in Washington County, and Multnomah County actually paid its own way. And what they did was they went through the caseloads and looked for people who actually might in fact be eligible for VA benefits. And I think they did it in the first 7 months that they went through this process. They found that they were able to help 78 people actually clear and obtain their VA benefits, and at the time that the pilot project ended, there were 200 cases pending. So what we learned from that very quickly was that if we put some attention and some energy into that type of a position, we could in fact help people, number one goal, and number two goal, save the state some money. So that was the pilot program that we put through the legislature last year. It passed the House, I think, 59-0 or 69-0. Somebody was absent, and didn't really make it through the Senate. But anyway, so we wanted to just kind of bring you up to speed on what our relationship is as O4AD, ding, and then I'll turn this over to Jeff to help round it out. And then we also have some public testimony today. We have in the audience with us about 16 or 17 members from Senior and Disability Services Advisory Councils from throughout the state who are visiting Salem yesterday and today and have a keen interest in this issue as well. The last thing I can say is that funding the county veteran services officers and increasing that funding is so much more important this year as we review the governor's recommended budget, and it's a stunning dissection of the entire Oregon model long-term care system. There isn't a single program in our long-term care system that was not cut or eliminated by the governor, and so it's a little different than in the past when we've come to you and said Oregon Project Independence has been cut or we're cutting levels of care. Now we can say to you that every single function that we provide in the long-term care system has either been reduced drastically or eliminated by the governor. Thank you.
Mr. Hill. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Hill. I'm the Veteran Service Officer for Washington and Columbia Counties, as well as the current president of the Oregon County Veteran Service Officers Association. I gave to you a packet, and there's quite a bit of information in there for you to review. I gave you some information on funding, some information on the pilot project that we conducted, so you can understand a little more in depth what we did, and just my testimony is also in there today. And I've also given you some statistics and some numbers from the federal VA so you can actually see the numbers for the state of Oregon broken down by county. The Oregon County Veteran Service Officers Association is an organization made up of 34 counties within the state. The only two counties who are not members are Marion and Polk, who do not have a county veteran service officer. These service officers are stationed in the county at the local level to provide services to veterans to assist them in gaining their claims or getting their claims through the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. As Jacqueline indicated, the county veteran service officers have been funded at $12,500 per year since 1982, actually. And we're not actually getting that amount per year. We're only actually getting around $10,100 because since the rate has never been increased, the funds have to go through 34 counties now, and we've added counties since 1982 to the county veteran service officers. So the additional counties have taken additional funds, so each county has taken an equal share of what's left in the pot. And it's my understanding that the governor's budget does not increase that funding again for this next biennium. So the County Veteran Service Officers had drafted a bill, and Senator Courtney is currently going to sponsor that bill, and I put a copy of that also in your packet for review. It'll probably be behind the paper that has the flag on it. What we're looking at is trying to fund County Veteran Service Officers at the same level that the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs funds their own staff. We made a study of their staff, and based on what their staff cost bundling their pay and benefits, we come up with a formula that for every ODVA staff, they basically serve 7,500 veterans if you just look at Marion and Polk counties, which they are providing services to. So if you funded us at the same level, at 1 to 7,500, that's how we kind of broke down our formulation for the request and funding that we made within the bill. What this does for veterans here in Oregon is it allows us to increase the number of County Veteran Service Officers providing services to veterans. As you can see by some of the information, there are 370,344 veterans currently in this state. That doesn't even take into account the dependents of veterans who also can qualify for benefits under the VA. There's one of mine. Acronyms there. Under the Veterans Administration for benefits. Yeah. A lot of people are not aware that the spouses of veterans, the widows, widowers of veterans, can receive a pension from the Veterans Administration. We are not adequately staffed to do the outreach that would be required to reach all the veterans in our communities. For example, within Washington County, we have 41,000 veterans. In Columbia County, we have not quite 7,000 veterans. We have a half-time person in Columbia County, and we have three staff people in Washington County, and they're currently have a caseload, just pending claims. They have 1,500 claims pending at any one time, and then they claims they've already gotten through the system that still require annual reports, income verification reports, so the benefits can continue. We roughly have about 4,000 of those. So it's quite a workload for three individuals to handle. The veterans in the claims process not only fully develop the claim for the veteran, gather all the evidence required of the federal VA to make a decision on the claim, we also represent the claim when they have an adverse decision made against them. So we will represent them in the hearings and appeal process. So and that is quite a long and in-depth process to go through. So I think that is kind of the gist of what we do and the reason we're asking for funding. One of the benefits that Jacqueline was explaining to you is on the Medicaid side of the business is for every veteran or spouse of a veteran that we get onto VA benefits, then eliminates the requirement for Medicaid to pay that cost, thus saving both Medicaid and general fund dollars. And the pilot project was developed to show that. And one of the essential parts of the that we were missing in the pilot project was how to easily identify veterans or dependents of veterans on the Medicaid roll. We had to actually go in and pull case counts and go hand review all those case counts. And during this pilot project, we discovered that the state of Washington had a program called PARIS. I'm not sure if you've heard about this program. And what that does, it's a national program. It's free to the state, and the state is actually, we kind of lobbied and petitioned with DHS to implement this program, which they have done. It's my understanding the first run was done in December, and they're going to be reporting sometime in January on the results of that. But what this program does is it does a data match with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, the Department of Defense, Medicaid, and Social Security, so it can identify those individuals who are receiving Medicaid benefits that are veterans, so we can move in and go in and help these individuals file a claim and get veterans benefits. Just in the 78 individuals that we got through in the 9 to 12 months that we were working was a significant amount of savings, which you can see if we do that across the state will more than pay for, you know, the funds that the state would have put forward to finance the bill that we're asking for. A kind of a side benefit that we found in this program was that it also identifies individuals receiving Medicaid benefits in Oregon or any of the other 28 states that are receiving Medicaid benefits. So that run is also going to help reduce the people receiving benefits in both, say, Washington State and Oregon. One of the states are going to have to eliminate or cut off the person. And that happens a lot along the border areas of the state where people cross the lines and receive benefits. We haven't seen the numbers on that, but in talking with the individual out of Washington, he says it's kind of significant, this first run of their findings. So it'll be interesting when the report comes out as to what that finds.
Great. Yes, Representative Farr.
Question. What would be the benefit of having the money distributed by DAS versus the Department of Veterans Affairs?
Okay. It would be logical to think, Representative Farr, that ODV, or Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, would be the best vehicle for that funding. Some history, why we wrote the bill to have DAS distribute the funds is the history here is the legislature in the last two bienniums has given the County Veteran Service Officers an additional $100,000 to provide services to veterans in the state. The first biennium that they gave this was 2001, and the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs decided to give that money back to the state as part of their budget cut. We found out about this, and we came to the legislators, and they said, no, we want this money to go to the County Veterans Service Officers. Then it was again provided in this last budget, this last biennium, and ODVA did return that to the state, unbeknownst to the County Veterans Service Officers. So I guess it's kind of a
self-protection,
yes.
Representative Hunt?
Following up on that, just so I'm clear, the $100,000 that was returned in those two biennials, it wasn't that was downsized proportionally like the
correct
across other programs. The entire $100,000 was not
correct. In the first biennium, when they attempted to give it back, I came and testified in front of both the Senate and the House and said that we understood that everybody should take a fair share of cuts, and we were willing to take 10%, as I think that was the governor's recommended cut across the board, and we said we understood that and we were willing to do that. Not only did they want to give back the $100,000, they also wanted to give back the $12,500. So their entire cut would have been on the backs of the County Veteran Service Officers.
So. Madam Chair, I did have one question for them on another issue, but I'm wondering if we might add that to a future agenda to find out what the... I already see you taking notes. Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could ask a question related to the bill that you have before us. Clearly, it sounds like your rationale is invest more in veteran service officers throughout the state, and we'll get more bang for the buck, more vets served, more federal dollars brought in, more benefits to vets.
Correct.
Would you have any problem incorporating some kind of accountability measure in this bill that says you invest this in us and we will guarantee you these are the measurable benchmarks and you can pull the money next biennium if we don't meet those benchmarks?
That's reasonable. That would be fine.
Representative Bofet?
Madam Chair, is that kind of a follow-up to the same topic, because I too read the bill and clearly see the issue Representative Hunt raised in here, and I'm not sure that, I guess my first question would be is, if we go back and we fix the Department of Veterans Affairs problem, and that's fixable, I guess my next question, right? Would it be palatable, and do you have a good enough working relationship with Department of Veterans Affairs if we fix that problem, regardless of what the funding level is? Can we remend the fence and still work with them? That's my question to start with.
My feeling is yes. We've been working on our communications and partnering. We're currently working with them on our training and accreditation, updating that. We have a joint committee on that. We also have a joint committee on technology that we're working with them on. the current director of ODVA seems to be open to communications with us at the current time.
Thank you. Follow-up question?
Yes.
Are you aware that, I'll say, virtually everybody that has testified before this committee has said that you are the focal point and you are the initial first responder to all veterans issues? That includes 300 and some odd million in federal expenditures. The director of the VA, I just screwed up myself. The director of the Veterans Administration Hospital had said, you're like the first point of contact for all the rural counties like Malheur, so on and so forth. We heard it from Mr. Willis that you're the first responder. They've been struggling in the demobilization and reintegration process in which Representative Hunt and I attended with Colonel Caldwell in the back and Representative Hooley. They're all saying that, you know, we need a one point, one source, and you're it. And everybody else says you're it, but you're the most mysterious, mystical program we can touch our fingers on around here. So have all these agencies all come to you and said, you know, when you have all these problems, you know, you're it, even though we cut your money?
We meet with them regularly. We twice a year with the Federal Department of Veterans Affairs. We meet twice a year with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. They are integral in providing our training, keeping us updated. We go to meetings with the medical centers. We go to meetings with the regional office. They're very aware we're here. That's why they said what they said. I think the lack of knowledge is probably within other bodies that aren't aware that we're here. I think the senior people with disabilities know we're here, and in the counties, the Department of Labor or Employment know we're there because they refer to us, and we refer to them on a regular basis. We, at least in my two counties, we work with them on job fairs and benefit fairs for veterans. So. I think people are aware that we're there. I'm not quite sure why we're mysterious.
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, if I might, as I've been listening to these hearings, it's been very evident that there's an awareness that there are county veteran services officers, but with a few exceptions, I have yet to hear anybody call them by their accurate name. Even Congresswoman Hooley, who commented on them being in the front line of defense, couldn't remember what their name was. And if you think about it, the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs has adequate funding in a nice big building, and these folks are doing all of the communication that they're doing and the outreach and so forth with this very limited staff around the state. So they're sort of they're a mystery, I think, due to budgeting is probably part of the situation. So the Department of Veterans Affairs here in town says that they represent Oregon, but I think, quite honestly, they do it by, when they do get a call from another area of the state, they respond to it by giving them the phone number of the county veteran services officer in that area. So the funding, clearly, I mean, a quarter FTE is not enough funding for these offices to function at a very high, very visible level. And counties are kicking in a little bit of funding around the state for some of these offices to fill out some of the staffing requirements, and there are some volunteers and a little bit of staff support. But for the most part, I think they're mysterious because they're not funded, and they're a small piece of the general fund.
Other questions? Representative Farr?
Seeing that there's a fiscal impact of $5 million, I did hear you mention that in Washington they saw some significant savings. Mm-hmm. What do you project the savings to the state?
I wouldn't know without being able to analyze the information coming from Paris.
I think she's got them a little mixed up there. if I could, please, Madam Chair, Representative Farr, the PARIS software, what it's really doing is identifying veterans who are using, for example, food stamps in both Oregon, claiming in both states. Is that where your question was coming from, or were you talking about the pilot program where we actually identify people?
Yes.
That's what I was thinking, because there are some numbers about the kind of savings that they realized in the pilot program, and I'll just give you an example of that. I think, as he said, in Washington County with 78 claims in 7 or 7 to 9 months, somewhere along that line, they saved $184,452 in general funds. So 78 claims, $184,000. And some of those people received sort of lump settlements for back, what's the word you're looking for?
It's retroactive.
Retroactive benefits. So at any rate, $184,000. Now you multiply that out over the life of that person and the amount of money that they would have used in state Medicaid services, and then you're talking some real numbers. And so one of the things that we tried to do was to actually create new positions using the projected savings, but that's apparently voodoo budgeting of some kind or another, so we weren't allowed to proceed with that. But you could see that the program paid for itself and actually put money back into the general fund. So again, it's one of those things where it's testable and there's data, it would all depend on how many more staff were given to them and those kind of things. But we do have data that does show projected savings. Excuse me.
Other questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes. President Boakley.
I'd like to, obviously you've taken note, have them back. And a couple of questions that when they do come back, Madam Chair, is they've given us a graphic distribution of Veterans Administration expenditures, which lists the veterans population. And I'm sure the county association, County Veterans Service Officer Association, could come back with a new format that lists by county where all the veterans. I have serious problems of handing another bureaucratic mess to the Department of Administrative Services, and since at least I have, according to several people, at least a sixth grade education from East Elementary School of Tillamook, I could look at the list and figure out what the distribution ought to be, because every opportunity this committee provides for someone else to administer administration costs money and fee assessments, and if the committee did undertake this at a future date itself, we could actually do the distribution model ourselves and look at it and say, this is what we want to do in the next biennium, which therefore guarantees no one's siphoning money off, Madam Chair. But I think that sort of plan, and if they could bring back a plan of, you know, like a card like this that they could give to every returning veteran that says, if you live in Umatilla County, call one whatever the number is. This is your point of contact. He'll help you get everybody else.
Right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Do you want to respond to that, Mr. Hill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Boakley, we can develop that and bring that information back. Another comment is that we do actually, and ODVA, when they, all the returning veterans from Iraq, do get a list of all the county veteran service officers and their phone numbers, and can they know who to contact when they do their debrief. And that's something that I was actually at the same briefing you were at, and one of the things I suggested is that we be included in those debriefs so they'll actually see the face of the individual that's going to be providing those services.
Thank you very much, and we'd like a copy. Can we get a copy of that list, the county
contact,
please?
Okay.
Thank you very much, and we'll appreciate that list by county and also the contact numbers that perhaps could become a brochure. I'm assuming that Marion and Polk County get services from somebody else, since they don't have a county officer. Who do they get services from?
Yeah, Madam Chair, they receive their services from the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, who has a claims office here in Salem.
And does the OD... Oh, that's a dollar. Does the Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs get funded a worker?
They actually have, Madam Chair, five staff that provide services to veterans in here in Salem, plus I believe they have one manager plus two support staff.
Representative Beinhart?
And that's for two of these counties, Polk and Marion County?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Have you calculated what it would cost to provide comparable services for the rest of the state?
Yes, sir, we have.
It's in the bill.
Right. That is how we derived our formula.
That's fine. Okay, thank you. I'm still working my way through the paperwork. I don't understand where you're going.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you for your
services to our veterans. And next, we'd like to call up Betty Palmer. And then be followed by Gary Rudier. If anyone else would like to speak today, you might want to sign up at the sheet on the table over here. Thank you. Ms. Pomeroy.
Well, good morning, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. By a little bit of introduction, I am a fourth-generation Oregonian and a 30-year veteran of active service. I spent 8 years on the Governor's Advisory Council to the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs and acted as chair 1 year. I have now been 5 years with the Washington County Department of Aging and Veteran Services Advisory Council and have a new position as the chair of the Senior Advisory Council of Chairs for the State of Oregon, which is, I don't know what that means, but it's a lot of words. With this background and my very deep interest in veterans affairs, I feel Oregon is very ill prepared, staffed, equipped, and funded to serve her more than 370,000 veterans and their untold surviving spouses. There are only 30 county veteran service officers in the state to support our veterans and the surviving spouses. That's a potential caseload of more than 12,000 veterans per service officer. That's a little overwhelming. Currently, the state funds just over $300,000 to support these officers. Counties provide other monies, and some of our service officers only work part-time. You can imagine how these poor folks out in Malheur and Harney County and Grant and some of the outreach places have to travel to find and service their veterans. Excuse me, I'll ding. Our support and promises to our veterans needs to be addressed. At a time when the World War II, Korean, and Vietnam era vets need more care and assistance, we are growing another generation of Middle East veterans who we don't know what needs they're going to have. And we need to be prepared. Veterans who have successfully gained Veterans Administration compensation have poured untold dollars back into the economy, not to mention those who move from state programs to federally mandated and funded programs, as mentioned by Mr. Hill in our pilot project. In Washington County alone, we have more than 40,000 veterans, and with Columbia County, another 7,000. And we create better than $75,000 a year coming back into the state and into our county through these benefits that those who have been identified receive. That's putting some more beans in some people's pots and supporting the trickle-down effect of all economy through other jobs. With our three service officers, we have a caseload in Washington County of better than 12,000 veterans per service officer. These figures don't even represent the numbers of the destitute widows and survivors of the veterans of the earlier wars who are leaving us in awesome numbers and very quickly. Most of these widows have spent down whatever monies they've had in order to take care of the veteran, and now they're having to turn to the state and to the counties for assistance. So we have a double-edged sword here of taking care of not only the veteran, but these aging widows. And we can't reach them with our Motley staffing. So I feel that we need to also adopt these programs. We need the funding. We need the service officers. And I think that if we can go forward with the Paris Project to identify these people and move them from state funds to federally funded programs, we're all going to be keeping our promises to the veterans that we've made. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ms. Pomeroy. I have forgotten, what does WAC stand for?
Women's Army Corps.
And is that where you served?
That's where I started in 1958.
And then went on to...
Well, I just stayed in the Army, and it became just a plain old Army after a while.
Well, we just want to thank you so much, and we're so grateful for your service.
No, we thank you.
And thank you for being here today.
It's my turn to give back.
Well, you've already given, and we're grateful. Thank you so much. Okay, is there other testimony today? Okay, we'll call on Gary Roudier. Mr. Roudier is the Chief Warrant Officer in the U.S. Army Reserve, an individual mobilization augmentee assigned to the Army Safety Augmentation Detachment, headquarters at FORSCOM at Fort McPherson, Georgia, and his duty title is Aviation Safety Officer. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you, and members of the committee. I'm from Northeast. For the record, my name is Gary Roulier. I'm from Northeast Portland. I'm not here on behalf of the United States Army Reserve Command or the Forces Command Safety Officer. I'm actually here as a private citizen, but here hopefully to provide a resource to you. And as I explain my background, it will become clear that I probably have a different perspective because I've been deployed on both Operation Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom as a safety officer for Forces Command Headquarters. I'm a Vietnam helicopter pilot. There are some in the room who would say that makes me inherently unreliable.
Join the crowd.
Next June, Madam Chair, I will begin my 40th year of service. When I left active duty, I should say I'm a graduate of the Institute of Aerospace Safety and Management at the University of Southern California, and have served up to an including division-level staff as a safety officer. When I left active duty, I remained in the reserves and therefore was positioned on 9/11 to volunteer for deployment. I joined the Army Safety Augmentation Detachment. I should explain, we are a small unit housed in G1 at FORSCOM headquarters. Specifically, we were created after Desert Storm when the historically we have lost as many soldiers to non-combat reasons, accidents, if you will, as we have to combat. If you track World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, it runs between 45% and 55% of soldiers we lose to non-combat losses. In Desert Storm, that number increased significantly, and we lost, I think it was 2-1. So the Army formed our unit. We are specifically designed. We are authorized 109 reservists. As most units are, we are significantly undermanned. Our mission is to go forward and assist commanders in their risk management and safety programs, generally for forward deployed units. I joined the unit in October of 01. In October of 02, I was deployed to Afghanistan, where I served as the aviation safety officer for the 82nd Airborne Division, Coalition Task Force 82. And then after my return, I was home for a few months and volunteered and joined the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment in Al Asad, Iraq, as their aviation safety officer. What I'm here to testify to this morning really are some of the efforts that we took specifically in the 3rd Armored Cav Regiment. I did go to the ATM before I came up here, just in the event that I...
You went to the what?
Oh. Very good, Madam Chair.
I don't even know what that stands for.
Automated teller.
Oh, okay.
The... although I'm more familiar with the active component of the Army as a reservist, that's who we serve in my particular unit. These days, generally your active duty components are augmented by heavy numbers of National Guard and Reserve forces. For example, in the 3rd Army Cavalry Regiment, we had a Army Reserve Military Police Company, a National Guard Engineer Battalion, some National Guard Signal Corps. We had Reserve Civil Affairs, and so they all become part of your unit, and obviously when a commander responsible for their risk management program at the overall unit, you have to begin when you're planning, particularly for redeployment, to look at those particular units because they have very specific problems that maybe are not consistent with the problems that you would have with the active forces who are going to go home as one, be at the fort, you have control of them, and you can go ahead and set up a program to begin training them for all the risks that you see occurring as you return the unit to home base. There are some very unique issues with today's conflict that we have not seen in the past, and particularly will affect, I think, our Reserve and National Guard forces. As we went through the effort, and this I should mention was in the late part of 2003, we started to prepare for the deployment of the unit in March and April of 04. We were very concerned about our National Guard and Reserve units that were attached to us because we didn't feel like we could, in our planning efforts, we saw some unique problems with them. But I want to talk generally about some of the issues that are facing all of the soldiers today, but certainly the National Guard and Reserve forces, and some of the issues that as risk managers, when we are in forward deployed areas, of course, we're dealing with soldiers who are people. They go through certain, I want to say, cycles during a period of deployment, and we try and identify and design programs to attack the particular problems in those cycles. One that comes to mind is my commander used to talk about smelling the barn door. In aviation terms, we call it get-home-itis, and that is that period of time before the unit prepares to redeploy when the soldiers, quite frankly, their head is no longer in the fight. Their head is now, they're starting to think about home and starting to think about reunion with their families and the things that they are going to see when they get home. In today's environment, that's a very difficult problem to attack because, quite frankly, they don't know when they're going home. An example comes to mind of the military police company that was attached to us in Iraq that was there when at Al Asad when we arrived. They remained there when we left. And went down to Kuwait, finally redeployed. They cleared customs and were 200 meters from their airplane when they were turned around and told to report to Najaf. They finally did arrive home after serving 15 months. But you can imagine as a risk manager and a commander the problem of trying to get your troops back in the fight at that point. Some of these soldiers, I should mention in the last year, I've been doing a lot of training for the United States Army Safety Center, teaching tactical safety to the Army's professional safety and occupational interns, and also tactical safety down at the National Training Center and at Fort Lewis. And this is one of the things we talk about are the uncertainties that you're dealing with soldier psyches, if you will, when they think they're preparing to go home and then they don't go home. One of my former students is now in Baghdad and was talking about this problem and keeping their head in the fight. And he is with a unit that is preparing to redeploy, and now they've been told that because of the elections and some of the expected violence, they will be retained. This brings up another issue that when we're looking at risk management, we talk about the issue of units coming home. And one of the important things to understand is that when units coming home, and this is certainly probably going to be a problem that the National Guard and Reserve Forces see as well, but certainly in the active component, is that when those units return, they are now turning back to Iraq in as little as 10 months. When units come home from a theater such as Iraq, particularly I can speak to an Armored Cav Regiment, they have not been performing their designed mission for almost a year. They've done no tank gunnery. They've probably done very little gunnery of any type. Certainly the aviation part of the force has not done any type of flying and gunnery that fits their mission. When they come home, they basically have to start at point A, go through all their gunnery tables and everything else to get ready to go again. And my point is, when they get home, they are operating at a very high tempo. And this is probably going to be true of the National Guard and Reserve Forces as well. So there's no respite there. The 3rd Army Cav Regiment, for example, returned in April, May time frame. They are down at the National Training Center as we speak. There's a tremendous amount of preparation that has to get them ready for that, and I think that they will be redeploying to Iraq very shortly. The unit I was mentioning that presently is in Iraq that was looking at a 10-month turnaround, of course, as they get extended now, that turnaround will shorten. So it's tremendously high tempo for all the active components. There is talk about possible pending legislation or ideas of lengthening the time that the forces, the Reserve and National Guard forces can be deployed. I think now the law says 24 months. They're looking at extending that. So this type of uncertainty of length and time in between, length of tours and time in between tours, is certainly, as a risk manager, affects the morale of the soldiers. So we look at those kinds of things when we are planning, doing our risk management plans for redeployment. And some of the issues that, as I was brainstorming this, that I thought might be unique to certainly some of the National Guard forces, and I know there are issues that you have probably taken quite a bit of testimony on, are such things as employment. Some of the issues that I would be interested in my own case in looking at is in the type of environment, and the type of technologically challenging environment we have today, I'm quite sure that a lot of our Reserve and National Guard soldiers, particularly if they wind up getting extended and serving longer than 24 months, quite frankly could come back and be technologically obsolete. Depending on what their career path is. They may be software programmers who drive a truck in the Army Reserves, and now they're gone for 2 or 3 years. And, you know, what type of training are they going to require when they return to actually make them employable in that particular field? Certainly there are a lot of soldiers who are having their educations interrupted for a significant period of time, who may find that, particularly if they're in an education track, where they're going to require some type of professional certification, I can certainly see them having a tremendous disadvantages. The other concern that I have from a risk management standpoint regarding National Guard and Reserve, and I don't want to get into all of the privately owned vehicle accident issue, all the reunion issues with families and that sort of thing. It kind of goes back to my experience in Vietnam, and I obviously know a lot of veterans and a lot of people who say that, you know, my father served in Vietnam and never talks about it. And my response to that is usually they automatically think that the reason the person won't talk about it is because they're uncomfortable with their service there or something bad happened to them, when in fact the only reason they don't talk to you about it is because you have no frame of reference to understand what they might be talking about. And I know a lot of veterans who will talk very easily with me, for example, because they know I've served, will not talk to their families simply because they wouldn't understand what they're saying. In the active component, obviously our soldiers they live in an environment with other soldiers. When they return from combat, that's who they are with on almost a 24/7 basis. For both the soldiers and the families of the soldiers, they are around people who have a shared frame of reference. That is not true for our returning Guard and Reserve forces. For 28 days a month, they are not around other soldiers. and will not have an outlet to, for example, speak to someone with a common frame of reference. This is also true of the families who are married to National Guard and Reserve forces who are deployed, who don't have the support system around them, for example, that someone at Fort Lewis or right outside the gates of Fort Lewis would have. So those are some of the issues that we certainly were looking at. I wish I had, I don't like to bring problems to a commander without offering a solution. I don't know enough about the veteran services that are available here in the state to say, are we adequately staffed and resourced to take care of the issues that we are going to have with some of our returning veterans. I do know I have been reading that there are estimates that the optimistic estimates say 1 in 6, the pessimistic estimates say 1 in 3 of our returning soldiers will need some type of counseling and assistance. I do tend more to the pessimistic side as far as my estimates. I also know that in recent reading that the Federal Veterans Administration, the proposed budget increase that I think is 1.5%, I would question whether that is adequate to handle what we are looking at as far as a huge increase in needed services for our veterans. The priorities, they're wonderful to speak about, but if they aren't funded, I would question the commitment. And with that, Madam Chair, I will open myself to any questions the committee might have.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your taking the time to be here. Questions?
I do, Madam Chair, and Chief, since you're sitting here, you get to be the target, so that we can, I guess, more education questions than anything else, Madam Chair. Would you talk briefly, I'm assuming that you're a you're going to find me, but the Chief will understand this, you're standard IMA versus a drilling IMA, is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, the IMAs have all been transitioned, if you will, to drilling IMAs.
Okay.
That happened, I think, in February or March of last year. If I could editorialize, my guess would be because of the difficulty of bringing. And, Madam Chair, I should explain, IMA is an individual mobilization augmentee.
Thank you.
The standard individual ready reservist is just kind of out there. An IMA, individual mobilization augmentee, actually is assigned to a unit. There used to be IMAs who just drilled for retirement points, and then we had, as Representative Boquist said, drilling IMAs who actually got paid. They've moved all of the IMAs into drilling IMAs now.
Excuse me, I was going to be paying for your talk. You went through about a couple bucks, right?
Madam Chair, can I follow up? Because I'm
yes,
going somewhere here, and I think the Chief probably knows where I'm going. And
okay.
At the same time, Colonel Peoples and General Swanick was ripping his ear off for flight safety issues. You know, I was on the ground at the same time, so we have a common hearing. And he brought up several points. And if you would, Chief, go to the next point, which is you explained that a drilling IMA like he is, he comes back, and I think we're at 36 UDIS. You can find me for this, but this doesn't, something along that. How often do you get a common frame of reference? What is funded? And then I'd like you to talk about the individual ready reserves, that when they come back, there is no common frame of reference. And then I'll hammer away at the issue of the fact that there is no funding for IDT and UDT and AT for Army reservists, which means there is zero common frame of reference when they come back.
Representative Boquist, why don't you just hand me your billfold?
See, Madam Chairman, if I didn't use this, we could be here for 2 hours. But I think the Chief exactly what I'm talking about.
Okay, I hope your wife doesn't miss those dollars in her budget.
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, I do know where you're going with the question. And it's interesting that in my particular unit, we've actually talked about this. We deploy, we're a little unusual in that we deploy individually. So what happens is in my case, the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment lost their safety officer. He went up to Corps. It's a good way to get out of theater. And then they requested and tasked through the big army down to Forest Com for one of our officers to go, and I took the tasking. So we are deployed individually. So we are more similar to the old Vietnam days where you got off the plane, you're out of the army, and there you are. That's exactly what we do. We come home, we go through the CONUS replacement center at Fort Benning, Georgia, for example, and you basically go in 24 hours, you're out of the Army. Now you're home. Although we are staff officers, we are still driving around in soft-skin Humvees subject to getting blown up and flying around an aircraft subject to get shot down. So for us, yes, we are kind of out there. And I think that for a lot of, and that's probably true with our civil affairs forces as well. There are many of our forces in the reserve and guard who will deploy in fairly small units that when they get home, simply are out, kind of out there by themselves. And so they don't have this kind of support system, as you will, around them. Before they came up with where we would actually have drilling individual mobilization augmentee positions, and in my case, I drill at Fort Lewis, Washington. But on the occasions when you're not drilling and you're not actually around those soldiers, you are kind of out there on your own. Also, I think, Representative Boquist, you were talking about funding for the different types of annual training and other things that we do. We have gone back and forth on that. There were times that I've seen adequate funds where we were certainly bringing soldiers in. What we're talking about here, for example, is our unit regularly supports exercises such as Roving Sands, which goes down to Fort Bliss. It's an air defense exercise. We have traditionally supported Bright Star, which is an operation in Egypt. And these are opportunities for our soldiers to go out and keep their training current. In the last 2 years, we have had adequate funding that we have sent some of our soldiers down to the Joint Readiness Training Center at Fort Polk, National Training Center at Fort Irwin. However, I was asked to come down and teach a joint class at, and joint, Madam Chair, is when we have the Army, Air Force, Marines, and Navy together, at Fort Rucker, which was a test program that the Army Safety Center was putting on, and it was very difficult to get funds approved for that. So I will tell you that in the question of funding, I did attend a quarterly Aviation Safety Council up at Fort Lewis when I was up there recently. They had a number of pending projects for improvements on the runway and that sort of thing, and were basically told by the facility engineers that you're looking at 5 to 10 years down the road for any of those projects to be done, anything of major construction, because all of the money was, of course, going to Iraq.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'll wrap this up because this all makes sense.
Please do.
Is the federal policy at this point, and I'm not beating anybody up, but the federal policy at this point is that when returning reserve component, and this includes National Guard, and Colonel Caldwell can address how they're doing something different at a high, but the returning federal policy is that if the unit comes back, there is not funding for them to do the weekend drill for 6 months, and there is not funding for annual training. Now, what that means is if a veteran has a problem, if a veteran has a mental issue, the one central place that you can focus on them is if they come to drill weekend. But we've taken that money away, and so literally, despite having all the greatest programs, once again, this comes back, who do they call? They're not going to drill. They're not going on the weekends. There's no annual training. I mean, and we could talk about a whole host of military reasons why it's a problem, but from the veteran's perspective, there's no point of contact. The only point of contact they have is the county veterans service officer and a card that they took home 4 months before. If they can find it. And they can, of course, call their armory because the active guard reserve in a reserve component, U.S. Army Reserve Unit, might be drilling. But General Byrne and the Oregon is fixing that by taking it totally out of high. And like, so
out of high.
Basically, they are funding it out of their own money. They're not authorized to do it, but they're doing it anyway because we need to stay in contact with these veterans and these reserve people. But the federal policy is not to do that. Take the money for 6 months because they want the money elsewhere, which then means where do they go? County services, state services, all these places that just fall into the cracks.
And Madam Chair,
if you could ask Colonel Caldwell to join you, please, and we'll just hear his response. Mm-hmm. And please go ahead while he's coming.
What I was going to say was that during our planning in Iraq for the returning unit, we were trying to address the issue you were talking about. We were taking great care to make sure that we kept control over our soldiers when they got home. Basically, we were going to get them off the plane, secure the sensitive items, turn them loose for 72 hours, and then we were going to bring them back in to do the type of training with the chaplain and the combat stress teams, the private-owned vehicle accident prevention programs, and there are a number of programs that we have put together for redeploying soldiers. We didn't want to turn them loose on their families without having them kind of go through a training process. We were going to keep them for half a day through a period of time. You don't have that opportunity with returning Guard and Reserve forces. They are just turned loose. And so even though we were putting together all these programs, we knew we were going to lose those particular parts of our soldiers. And it's a very difficult problem, particularly if they, you know, I mentioned earlier, if they don't have that frame of reference for 28 days, but now you're talking about they don't have it for 30 days, and there really is no way for a commander or risk manager, safety officers, or whatever, to capture the issues. We did have a program in place to try and identify soldiers that we felt that were at risk prior to redeployment. And we're talking about at risk. You know, if we could identify family issues and that sort of thing beforehand, then we could spend the additional resources that we had for those particular soldiers. If that doesn't do much good, if you can't do anything on the other end to try and assign some resources to help those soldiers. And what Representative Boquist is saying is exactly right. That is to a risk manager, that's a real red flag. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Colonel Caldwell, could you address this issue, please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Colonel Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. What Representative Boquist indicated here, and the Chief, is absolutely on mark. It's not 6 months, it's actually 90 days is what we're restricted. We cannot bring our soldiers back for 90 days. We don't have the funding, and we're told by National Guard Bureau not to do that. When we looked at this situation, we've had experience with units coming home. We've had aviation unit come back. We've had a 82nd Rear Operations Center come back. 1st Battalion, 162nd Infantry come home, all from Iraq or Afghanistan, one of the two. And we recognized after getting some feedback from families and from soldiers after the 90-day window, in fact, just to give you an example, the 90-day window, 50% of our people showed up for drill. And we'd had virtually no contact with them other than if they came to us, which created some real issues, you know, not only for their membership, but for their, you know, for their making sure that they got a good year, making sure that they performed properly, and after here serving their country, doing a good job, could end up basically being discharged with a less than honorable discharge. We do not have the ability to order them back in. However, what we've come up with and what Representative Boquist is commenting on is indeed we are not funded by the federal government to deal with this subject, and we don't have the staffing. We've never been staffed for that in the Oregon National Guard. So what we've done is probably thank the good Mother Nature for this, because we've saved some money on heat and lights this winter, and we've moved that money over, and this is state dollars now. These aren't federal dollars. And we've put on a temporary retired colonel who used to deal with personnel issues. It was our personnel director, and he's forming together this group that we're putting together, not only with mainly with volunteers and other agencies, employment, Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, Federal Veterans Affairs, and all the different entities, to try to come up with a complete program that we can get out to our units and make sure that when they come home that they're aware of it. We're also going to offer a 4-hour period in different increments, like on a Thursday night, a Friday night, and a Saturday morning, perhaps, at 30 days out. We can't order our people to come back, but we're going to invite them and encourage them to come back at the end of 30 days after they return to do what the Chief is indicating. First thing that people think, another amazing aspect of this, we spend probably on a minimum of 90 days, probably closer to 120 days, from the time the unit is mobilized to the time they're deployed in training.
we get 7 days to decompress them. And that's the time they hit Fort Lewis till the time they have to be off our books and home. So, I mean, there's a real gap here. There's a real ignorant viewpoint of these things at some level way above our pay grade. And we simply don't have the funds to do it. And again, if it wasn't for the state, if we weren't lucky enough to have a good winter and not be able, and we budgeted money to spend for heat and lights for a cold winter and we just haven't had it, we freed up some dollars and we've moved them. That's only going to get us till July. In July, we're out, and this temporary state employee is gone. We're hoping to get the federal government. General Burns going back next week. Talk to Guard Bureau. This has been the high number one on his agenda on his last trip and this next trip to discuss this and to try to free up dollars to do exactly what we're talking about in this reintegration. As indicated earlier by one of your presenters, if there's one third of these individuals that are going to need care of some sort, and just in our case right now, we've got 1,501 soldiers in Iraq today. We have returned over right at 2,000 in the last since 9/11. And so we're looking at 3,500, 4,000, and by the end of this next year, we'll have another 900 deployed. So we're going to have 5,000 to 6,000 soldiers in this state that are Oregon Guardsmen that are going to be coming back within the next 12 to 18 months, and they're going to be turned loose on our communities, basically. And their first point of access is probably going to be that county veterans affair, or the county the veterans individual. And not that this is what you asked me, but I'm going to also add in another plug here. As a former county commissioner for 8 years in Union County, we were part of that $12,500 for our county veterans affairs officer. We always extended ours out to make a full-time employee there, and I think that's what is going on even today in that county. Small county, but we thought it was important, and we took that out of our hide, out of the county general fund dollars. So if I'd put in a plug for anything, I'd say that these are some of the most important people that our veterans are going to see, that our soldiers are going to see, when perhaps they don't want to come to the Armory, perhaps they don't feel comfortable coming to the Armory, and they may find this a better access for them to come and seek assistance, because that's really what we have. Federal Veterans Affairs Department has outreach centers in Medford, Eugene, Salem, I think in Portland, if I'm not mistaken. Is that what they said the other day? I think it was four. So there's only four of those outreach centers sitting out there from the federal side of the house in the state, great state of Oregon. And we're going to have veterans in 36 counties. And we're going to have returning guardsmen in 36 counties. So that's what we're doing. That's what we're trying to do to try to stick our finger in this hole in the dike. It's certainly not, we know it's not adequate. We're trying to fix this bicycle while we ride it. And that's very difficult. And we've made some mistakes in the past because we were too busy, frankly, chopping wood. We didn't stop to sharpen our axe. And we finally had to stop and say, we've got a problem here. We've got to look at this. We've got to recognize it. And frankly, when we saw the problem was when we saw the returning, when the first drill came up 90 days later, we're seeing 50% recovery. We're going, whoa, something's wrong here. Something's broke. And we had to go back in and start peeling the onion back. The other thing that we were going to do that we didn't do in the previous deployments is we're not going to rotate the commander for at least 6 months. We're thinking even extending that to a year, leaving the leadership in place for 6 months to a year so they can, you know, keep in touch with their soldiers that they serve with. As the chief indicated, this frame of reference is so important to those people, and all of a sudden you come in and the commander, first sergeant, sergeant major, everybody rotates to another assignment, and suddenly the soldier's coming back and they got new people who didn't serve with them, who didn't go with them, who don't understand what they're going through, and then it becomes more difficult. So we recognize that, and we said we're not going to rotate commanders. We're going to leave them in place, and we think that'll help.
Thank you so much. We appreciate both of you very much, and we hope you'll give us the opportunity to bring you back another time. We have another individual to testify at this time, and I'd like to call on Rob Johnstone.
Madam Chair.
Oh, excuse me. Representative.
While they're in the process of moving, I would like to note for the record that when I had a visit in December with the General and the Colonel talk about the National Guard, the Colonel was also in civvies that day, and I asked him about that, and his response was that on the days he's off, he doesn't wear his uniform. So I think this is another example of how the State National Guard manages to stretch resources.
If you don't burn your leave, you lose it. So I'm burning my leave.
I have to. In 5 years, this is the first time I've ever seen him out of uniform. So I guess today's his first day off in 5 years.
Well, this wasn't 5 years ago. I dropped it.
Park manager is first, but he's here working on his day off.
Mr. Johnstone comes up to testify, I'd just like to take this privilege to say that in my county, the county veterans officer, who is partially funded, has a space about 6 by 10. And recently, through a grant, has received, I believe, funding for training of two or three, you know, individuals from employment that need to learn a skill who can work a few hours. And they're all right there. And knowing her workload, and that's probably why she's not here today. She was on our agenda, Diane Salenti. She's outstanding. But the reason I mention that is space is an issue, and also because this individual coming to testify is the former chairman of the Yamhill County Board of Commissioners for whom she worked at one time.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnstone.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you stole about half my testimony already.
Oh, sorry.
But that's okay. I actually didn't come intending to testify. My name is Rob Johnstone. I'm actually employed by Mid-Willamette Valley Senior Services Agency as advisory council support and advocacy, just staff support for them. I'm not a lobbyist, and I'm here on my coffee break. I'm not representing the agency, but I did want to just share three examples from my own experience. First, when I graduated from high school, I had an appointment to the United States Naval Academy. And when I left the Navy, this was in the late 70s, and I've looked back and wondered if this was because of everything that was going on behalf of the Vietnam veterans, or whether or not it was the fact that I was a junior grade officer or what, but I had offers for help from the federal government when I left the Navy, more than I was willing or able to avail myself to at the time. So my first exposure to that kind of a thing was very positive, that I was getting offers for help that I thought everybody was and would continue to get. I think things have changed. In 1994, I was elected Yamhill County Commissioner, as you mentioned, and served two terms. And Diane Salenti has been our County Veteran Service Officer and was in my office on more than one occasion in tears because of her concerns about the lack of support to serve the veterans that she cares so deeply about, her husband being a Vietnam veteran himself. And she volunteered hundreds of hours of her own time working on projects, and we had to be very careful in not discouraging her from doing that, but making sure that it was separated such that it couldn't be time that could come back on us for additional compensation, or that we could receive a workers' comp claim if there was something to happen in that. But she was so committed to the veterans and to the mission that she had that she volunteered many hours outside the office on special projects. And as you mentioned, it's a tiny office, but she is committed, and the county has always matched at the very minimum the dollars that came from the state to provide her position from the $12,005, and now it's just over $10,000 per year. And we, in order to justify that, to bring her to full time, we actually had to assign her responsibilities beyond her duties as veteran service officer, but for the most part basically let her creep that work into whatever it took. And she would file regular reports, and I'm assuming that this was part of the responsibility she had to the state on the amount of money recovered by her efforts on behalf of veterans, and it amounted to millions of dollars every year in tiny Yamhill County. I mean, we have less than 20,000 veterans in Yamhill County, but because of her efforts, the return on that investment was huge. And if the bill that's being considered now for the parity or whatever that's called in funding county service veterans officers, number one, increases the amount of recovery, it's going to pay for itself in the economy of the state of Oregon. Second, if it can shift some of the responsibility for services provided to veterans now through Medicaid, if it can move them off of that, I mean, the governor's budget now talks about investments in programs. This, and most of the investments often deal with, especially in human service areas, on quality of life issues for Oregonians. But this one results not only in quality of life improvements, but in dollars returned to the state by not having to provide Medicaid services to people who are eligible through veteran services. So I think that's a very positive thing. The third experience is my own son. When he left the Air Force in 1998, shortly before that, he received a service-related injury when he was serving over in Korea, where he'd been for the last 15 months. And needed an operation on his knee, and they wouldn't do it in Korea. They didn't think they had the expertise, and the rehab time was longer than he was scheduled to remain in the service. So they sent him home and told him to get the operation when he came back. And he had a very difficult time navigating the process. He had a very narrow window of time. He was home in August. He had about 8 weeks before he was actually discharged, and he had to arrange to get this operation and get into the rehab, and nobody could give him the time to help, but they gave him phone numbers. It supplied information, and he did all of the legwork and the phone calling himself because he's young and energetic and really wanted to get this done and get it paid for. So he was successful. But I contrast his experience with mine from 30 years earlier, that I felt like I was having help thrown at me that I didn't need to avail myself to, and my son, who really needed it, had to work like a dog to even get access to know who to talk to and get it there. He was able to get it taken care of, and it worked out for him. But over the span of time, I think there's been a shift in accessibility and customer service, if you will, in some of these areas. And so I just want to say, based on my personal experiences, having services offered to me 30 years ago, my experience as a county commissioner working with a county veteran service officer, and then his more recent experiences of my son who needed service benefits when he left the Air Force 7 years ago, I've seen a continuum here, a change, a divergence, and I appreciate the fact that you all are considering a bill or any kind of a process that would help provide some measure of equity to county veteran service officers that are on the front line of recovering dollars on behalf of the veterans that go into the state economy and can perhaps save at another end of the process through this investment. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any questions of Mr. Johnstone? Thank you so very much.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Appreciate that testimony.
I have one thing, yes. I wanted to mention, Madam Chair, before the members leave. We did receive from Gerald Lorang, the Federal Veterans Administration person, the booklet, Federal Benefits for Veterans and Dependents. I'll bring one of these around each of your offices. I noticed that it has on the cover a drawing of the new World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., which you ought to go see if you have a chance.
All right. We really appreciate the information today and those of you who made time to be here to help us out. And with that and this great committee's support, we are now adjourned. And thank you, administrators.